Spring is my favorite time to start a new workout routine. With the weather warming up, it feels easier to get into the rhythm of things. Whether you have 20 minutes or an hour for a Pilates class or outdoor guided walk, Peloton has everything you need to help you get going. Get a head start on summer with Peloton at onepeloton.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Welcome to Better Than Life, the episode-by-episode breakdown of Red Dwarf. I'm Fergus, and I watch this show a lot.
And I'm John, and I'm rewatching it for the first time in decades, and we are joined every episode by a different comedian. This week, it's Kirsty Newton and Nick Doody, a doubleheader for Polymorph.
It's a show about a man who's lost 3 million years in space. His company and evolved cat and a hologram he hates. Plus a fuzzy robot and a ship that's gone senile. We love the jokes and sci-fi stuff, that's why it's better than
John, I'm excited. It's a first for Better Than Life. We have a record number of guests this episode, literally doubling previous efforts. First up, we have a globally renowned virtuoso of music and comedy. She's a regular with the Comedy Store Players and Paul Merton's Impro Chums. She provided musical direction to shows and comedians more times than I've had gazpacho soup. And she's got loads of upcoming solo gigs and sing-alongs up and down the country, which, listener, you are sure to want to see once this hour is up. It's Kirsty Newton!
Hey.
And in an awesome two-for-one marriage-type deal, we also have a brilliant stand-up with 12 full fringe shows and writing credits for loads of your favourite comedy programmes. If you've enjoyed a joke recently, there's a much greater than zero chance this legend was behind it. He's played just about everywhere in the world with some of the greatest comics in history. That he's gracing the Better Than Life basement with his presence is a true honour. It's Nick Doody.
Hey. Hello.
Thanks so much, both of you, for joining us. We've got a lot to talk about with this classic episode, Polymorph. But first, how long into your marriage were you before you discovered your mutual love of Red Dwarf? Or was it the reason you found each other in the first place?
It's so weird because we only got a TV in the pandemic. That was the first time we'd actually had a TV.
Gosh.
We've been together now, 17 and a half years, and we've only had a telly for less than four.
And let's be fully honest here. That telly does not have an aerial.
No, it does not.
Plugged into it. It's essentially just a bigger screen. We can watch all the same stuff we could watch on our phones.
Slightly closer to how the creators intended.
Yeah, I think we've known for a long time that we were both kind of Red Dwarf fans. In fact, you mentioned the sing-alongs. When I first started doing the sing-alongs in Crouch End, actually Rob Grant came along to a few of them at the beginning and I was a bit starstruck.
Wow.
And Nick was, I think, were you writing with him or something?
So I had this idea earlier. Do you know what an Euler number is in maths?
No, I feel like I should.
There's a thing in academic mathematics, like basically how many removes a paper you've had published is from something that Euler was a co-author
amazing,
on. He co-authored things with bloody everybody, right? Really prolific and promiscuous.
So it's like an academic Kevin Bacon sort of thing.
It's exactly. It's a six degrees of Kevin Bacon. I thought, like, wow, what's your RD number?
Yeah.
Everybody's got one. And we realised, because obviously we've been talking about knowing when we're coming on the podcast. Both of us, but me for longer, used to live on the same road as Rob Grant.
Oh, yeah.
It's a very nice house. Because I went to it once and wrote sketches with him.
Awesome. Oh, my gosh.
Cool.
I think I met him, and then as he walked away, my friend went, that's Rob Grant. What, Red Dwarf? Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, wow, cool.
He is cool, right? He's quite unassuming and quite...
He's really lovely.
Yeah, he's very sweet. He's very nice. And he was very lovely about my made-up stuff. And in the same area of North London, in fact, is where I recorded my first album when I was doing the Siskin thing, which was produced by Stephen Leroni, who is married to Claire Grogan.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, the original.
Wow.
Kuchansky.
Which, and I actually did go on her Six Music, this is a while ago now, so yeah, she's had a Six Music programme, so I went on that as well.
Yeah, in terms of calculating your RD numbers, you it's one, right, for both of you?
Yeah.
That's pretty good. Let's assume you both got into it when it was first on telly, like in the late 80s, early
90s? Absolutely, yeah. I saw the pilot when it was broadcast that night.
I think right. I did as well.
Really? We've been speaking to a lot of people who kind of came in when it got big.
Are they younger than us? They're younger than us, aren't they?
A little bit younger. I can remember that night so clearly still. And I can remember the next morning at school when no other bugger had seen it.
That was my experience as well, because I ended up watching it with my sister a lot because no one else at school was really watching it, especially the girls, I think. And so it was very much a me and my sister thing that we watched together. And she was 2 years younger than me. So it was like, you know, she kind of did a lot of what I wanted to do because I just made her be my Red Dwarf partner, really.
For a show with an entirely male cast, we talk about this a lot on the podcast because we have a lot of female guests and it feels like an important question to bring up every now and again. They're all blokes. What was in it for you?
I think it was just because it was so funny and it felt quite naughty, but I loved the kind of coziness of it as well. And just even now when I hear the theme tune, I kind of go, oh, I think it reminds me. The first time I watched it, it must have been about 11. It was before horrible teenage angst had come along, you know. It was, you know, so
yeah,
it still kind of reminds me of that kind of cozy sitting around, you know.
Yeah, absolutely.
On the telly.
Well, I was slightly older, but not showbiz older, like 2-3 years older. I remember my sister's friends, who were like all the fanciable women I knew, were some professor friends of my sister's in my teens. But there was a point when they sort of all had crushes, like on Chris Barry even. Like girl I was seeing briefly wrote a poem about Chris Barry, I remember.
What? Blimey. How did you take that?
You know, what a sort of left field person to have a crush on, you know.
He's very talented, he's very diverse. He shares what I imagine most kind of rubber-faced character comedians have, which is that they tend to be a lot more attractive when they're not playing the character. Mm. Well, as has been mentioned, he gets his kit off in series 4 or something, doesn't he? When he's all tied up and he's buff. It's like he requested it. But what about that music, though? There is something very comfortable. But having come in at series 1, I find the bleak opening credits of series 1 and 2, the kind of more funereal version of the song, I even find that comfortable now. Is that weird? Like, it's not designed to make you comfortable, that piece of music.
But you heard it before you heard the song, right?
Yeah, it's about 29 minutes before, yeah.
That got into your head before you go, oh, the whole words now.
Yeah, it's the, you know, the... It's the kind of grandioseness of it, isn't it? It's just the makes it kind of, oh, this is exciting. It was really exciting, especially for an 11-year-old, because it was all a bit, you know, they kind of sounded like they were swearing, but they weren't swearing.
And so with that music, was that a little bit Blake 7? I mean, that is an old reference, but it wouldn't be too old
at the time
for Grant and Naylor.
Mm.
I think, no, not at all. They're heavily influenced by 50s, 60s. Well, and we're going to see in this episode, I think, 70s sci-fi. I think everyone went a bit... There's famous stories about the cast hearing the song version for the first time and going, have they got it wrong? Like, have they... But actually, musically, there are little cheeky bits in it. The move from that... What you just played, D minor to F minor, that's very unusual. That's very sci-fi pair of chords to go together. And it feels like space.
Exactly. It's how expansive it is, how it kind of, you know, opens out. But it's Howard Goodall, isn't he? I mean, he's great.
He's a genius. He did the QI theme as well?
Yeah, he did, yeah.
So he has a habit of placing really odd genre of music up against TV comedy.
But it works, especially when it's comedy. It kind of works to be subversive, I think. That's, you know, it makes you go, what? But then you are always going to remember that because it's not going to be the same as another one, is it? You know, cause sometimes themes can be a bit samey and you go, oh, which one is this? It could be that one.
It's a very nerdy rabbit hole to go down. How it kind of got decided in the popular consciousness that this sort of music goes with this sort of genre.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's true. Why is this sort of plucked guitar? Why is that anything to do with spies?
There's usually
a sort of an example of the genre.
What is that?
There's probably an argument. I mean, I'm wading into waters that I really don't know that I can swim in. Yeah, but yeah. Holst's Planet Suite is pretty influential, right?
Yeah, very much so.
Oh,
yeah.
John, look at you.
Mm. All of the Strauss in 2001, A Space Odyssey.
Yeah, right.
The idea that outer space has a kind of ponderous classical thing going on. Mm.
Well, I mean, John Williams has been like influenced by the planets, especially Mars, I would say.
Yeah, yeah.
And then people borrow from John Williams. So it's like kind of chain effect where this sounds like space. Well done, Holst.
Whereas Howard Goodall's out there on his own, out in left field, making up three different versions of the same song, essentially. Because from Series 3, we don't get that bleak, funereal version. We get the rocking guitar solo version.
Which makes you really insanely happy and bounce around.
Which is good before a comedy, right?
Yeah.
That makes more sense somehow, but I prefer the old miserable one.
Well, I think it's also, it's that whole thing of... They kind of progressed it into that was from series three, was it?
Yeah,
like
that's
kind
right.
of yeah. So that's when it was starting to get a bit more ingrained. Cat had stopped being just a cat.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Starting to kind of have a few more human characteristics, and so it could actually develop plots a bit better and stuff like that and have a bit more dialogue.
Although one of the things I really loved when whatever age I guess 13 and 14 about the pilot, just the concept of you've been asleep for 3 million years and your cat is now this Ons. But I loved that idea of like, oh god, they've created another humanoid by just waiting. That really tickled the sci-fi fan in me, you know. All right, and as he is in episode one, like that character would be unbearable to sustain at that intensity that shallowly for as long as, but obviously he develops
and he was my favorite character. The cat was my favorite character because he was just so funny. I think as an 11-year-old I was just like, this is brilliant. And I just loved the way he moved. It was just very funny.
Yeah, he is amazing. He gets talked about, I think, more than the other characters in the show, to be honest, because he's so charming and because we've kind of debated why he's so one-dimensional and how he evolves. Obviously, it's because I imagine Danny John-Jules said to the writers, please, as John, you said, please, can I have something more to do, please?
Let me show my range.
Was it the sci-fi or the comedy that drew you in more, or was it both, the mix of both?
For me, it was probably the comedy, because even though I kind of like sci-fi, I wasn't obsessed with it, probably in quite the same way. I'm not sure obsessed is the word, but that as kind of immersed in it as I think Nick probably was.
Yeah, I have always loved sci-fi. And also I'd sort of started to get really interested in comedy in my teens. So it was sort of...
Perfect confluence.
Bait for me, yeah.
How long... did you guys keep up the watching of it? Do you remember getting into it, then getting really into it, then getting not so into it? Or how did it work for you guys?
I was really into it from the beginning and watched it avidly. And then I think in my teens, I wasn't watching as much TV. And then I left for university it was 30 years ago. So it was 94. So I think I probably then didn't have a TV for a long, 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 long time. So I kind of stopped watching around that time just because I couldn't.
I had a similar experience to Kirsty of going off to university, but in my case in 1991, very, very few people had their own TV. There was one in the JCR. And if someone else is watching Red Dwarf, you go, Red Dwarf. And you sit down and watch it, you know, 20 other people with a pint.
One of the themes that's come up is how little social value Red Dwarf has had. My understanding was that comedy was a bit of a geeky thing to be when I was a teenager, and sci-fi was also a geeky thing to be into. So Red Dwarf was a doubling down of that geekery. That to take to university and expose to your peers is quite a brave thing to do. So it's nice that you found your Red Dwarf niche occasionally.
I mean, yeah.
But yeah, for the sense of things, you both caught the heyday, the kind of series 1 to 6 kind of era when it was huge.
Absolutely.
You never got so far into it. I guess you were cool university students. You weren't wearing T-shirts saying Smeghead.
No, I wasn't, but I knew people who were doing things like that. I was briefly stalked by the Douglas Adams Appreciation Society, which is just quite, I turned up thinking, these might be fun people to hang out with. And they go, they are. I mean, by my standards, these people are very nerdy.
I think the reason that I really got into it, even because I mean, I think probably a lot of people did, because they're all misfits. All the characters are misfits, and they're kind of thrown together and kind of have to deal with each other's completely different ways of going about life. And as an 11-year-old to 18-year-old, I guess that was when I was watching it, that's very much how I felt. Like, didn't really fit in with anyone around me and was just trying to get by. I guess that's why I kind of really identified with it and loved it and felt very at home with it.
Yeah, you said earlier on, there's solace in it, right? There is some comfort in it. And you fit the nail on the head. I think it is that no matter what type of outsider you are, you're going to see yourself in at least one of the characters.
But it also has that thing, of having a range of appeals at the same time on sort of different intellectual levels. It really reminds me, like rewatching it, has really reminded me of something that Matt Groening said once about The Simpsons, which was that we have an incredibly clever set of jokes that are only understood by 10% of the audience. But, you know, for everyone else, every now and again, we make Homer bang his head and say, no.
That's the breadth of good comedy writing, right? Red Dwarf definitely got that.
There's a fantastic example of that, yeah, when we get to Polymorph, yeah.
Yeah.
Because you said your favourite character is the cat. Did that stay the same all the way through? And Nick, do you have a kind of standout character you enjoyed watching?
Obviously, Rimmer has the most kind of, like, he's the most ridiculous character. I guess I identified with Lister most, I guess, yeah. Well, especially my mum and the state of my bedroom during my teens, yeah.
I definitely the same mostly, but I also I think a lot of good shows have this thing where your favourite character constantly changes.
And
like for 5 minutes you'll think, oh, they're the best character, and then you completely change your mind 5 minutes later. But similar to Kirsty, I think Lister is the one I would most imagine as being more like me.
Neither of us is as vain as the cat, and hopefully neither of us certainly is not officious as Rimmer, and neither of us is as fastidious as Crichton. So
nice.
Although you are a little bit Crichton-esque with your
Because of my attachments.
your groinal socket.
Well, somebody's got to do the vacuuming.
No one does that, do they? That was my point.
That's why we're both Lister.
Yeah, exactly.
If you could recast the show any way you would want, using any cast from any period of time, who would you cast?
I would delegate to my husband.
I am not used to this.
I know. I never do that. You've brought out a new side of our marriage.
Wow. Good.
I do. No, I delegate the cooking to you.
Delegate. That's a nice word.
Delegate. Yeah.
All right. It's only because I've burnt down two kitchens, so that's the best. Yeah.
I thought of it as a question about, okay, let's say they were doing it. Let's say they just announced they were going to produce a completely new, you know, new to Amazon Prime or Netflix or something.
Right.
You go, all right, who's making this and why? Oh, it's okay, it's Hollywood.
Oh, no.
I started out with, do you know Papa Essiedu?
Yes.
Yeah. Right. So I was thinking that he, if he can be slovenly enough, has definitely got the sort of comedy chops to play Lister.
Yeah.
Yes. And if you saw the Black Mirror episode he was in, he was so immediately likable and a little bit down at heel.
Yeah, perfect.
I thought he'd be brilliant. And that's sort of outside the Hollywood side of things. But Rimmer, I had real issues with who can be as unlikable and creepy and then some turn around. And Michael Emerson.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. Yes.
That's who I came up with.
He's that guy that hovers on that edge of likability and absolute. If I'm thinking of the right person, Lost and Person of Interest.
Lost, Person of Interest, Evil. He's the most evil person in Evil.
Right.
He could be so fastidious. Yeah. He's almost a serial killer.
Yeah.
But also so petty. I don't know. I think he could really pull it off. And then I started really amusing myself. All right, if we're going kind of A-list here, why not just get Reese Witherspoon as Holly?
Lovely.
Why not?
Lovely.
Just brilliant.
Hey, guys.
She could produce it as well.
Yeah.
Sure. Yeah. For Crichton, I hope this isn't taken as rude. I end up with Ben Affleck.
Ben Affleck as Crichton.
Just really on a shape of head. You have to make the most minor adjustments. He's almost cuboid. And finally, Kat. Look, I don't know what the rules are. now about whether, you know, you have to recast according to gender or race or even species. But I think the film Cats really killed human beings playing cats for all time. I think it was so awful and creepy, and everybody in it looked like they'd just seen the video in The Ring. It was really like, you know, you think you don't like James Corden now, give him six extra nipples. So I ended up, Cat either has to be changed to dog or has to be played by Taylor Swift.
Oh my God.
Because Taylor Swift is the only one in Cats that you don't want to immediately kill with a chisel and bury at a crossroads.
My favourite thing about this casting would be the trailer, that kind of Disney-style trailer that comes up. Esadu, Emerson. Okay, Witherspoon. Hang on, what? Affleck? Wait, hang on a sec. Taylor Swift. Wait, Red Dwarf? Yeah. Let's get into it. Let's get into this episode proper. John, would you take us through the beats?
Right, so Polymorph opens with our first ever pre-credits warning. Ooh. An extremely hostile creature has escaped from a genetic waste pod. It feeds on the human psyche, seeks out the deranged, the unbalanced, the emotionally crippled. Oh, look, it's chewed its way into Red Dwarf. It's going to be very happy when it sees the menu. Shocked by its own reflection, the little monster shows off its shape-shifting powers as it cycles through all the funniest forms Grant and Naylor could think of. And the horror doesn't let up as we learn what Lister's put on his own menu and what he's using as cutlery. His taste in alcohol seems to have matured. At least he's no longer such a reverse snob about wine. Meanwhile, Rimmer is relaxing in front of some home movies of his boyhood self being tortured. And I'm sorry about this, listeners, but an embarrassed Creighton tries to clam up and stop taking the piss skein out of Rimmer's mum before they have a row. But he just can't snap her out of it and change his tuner. Enough squidding around.
No,
I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I'm done.
This is an Andy Zaltzman podcast.
I'm done now. No, I'm finished. Okay. Salmon, more important, happens as the polymorph strikes with a ruthless shrinking underpants gag. This definitely not an alien is definitely explained as not an alien moments after sucking out Lister's fear in a decidedly not the sort of thing an alien would do way. It's not an alien, okay? Lister votes for getting out there and twatting it, drink, while the others are unanimous for just getting out of there. Round of applause for the word bazookoid. Standing ovation as the polymorph expertly provokes and feasts upon Cat's vanity, Crichton's guilt, Rimmer's anger. The crew are divided on how to respond. Lister wants to nut this maggot to oblivion with a nuclear forehead. A young Rolf Harris proposes a major leaflet campaign. They win the day thanks to doors opening at the exact moment the polymorph attacks, proving Anton Chekhov's maxim that if a heat-seeking blast from a bazookoid are fired in Act 1, they sure as hell better bring justice to a genetic mutant in Act 3. Watch out! It's Lister. Polymorph. What a romp. Overall take, what did you think of the ep? I've got lots of specific questions I want to ask you, but I'd just love to know how it landed for you, because it's been a while, right, since either of you really checked in with the dwarf.
Yeah, ages.
How was this as a return to that world?
It was lovely, actually, because I felt kind of... I remembered from the moment that you see the camera from through the mouth of the polymorph kind of going up to them, I was like, oh, yeah, I remember this.
Yeah.
This is great. And very silly. And I love the noises, the little cute little noises it makes. The
noises are awesome, yeah.
I really liked it because I love my sci-fi. And this is very much a parody of one film a lot and a couple of other films a bit.
Yeah.
Which films are you going for there?
I am thinking of the classic late 70s Ridley Scott film Alien.
Mm. Yes, I was thinking of that one too.
But also a little bit of The Thing.
Yeah.
The Thing, where it could be anything it wants is very
nice. Yeah. From the short story The Thing from Outer Space, and then the John Carpenter film.
It kind of references another John Carpenter film, right? Those Dark POV Star? Shots are very Halloween.
Well, Halloween. Yeah.
That Red Dwarf is Dark Star, right?
Right. Yeah. The POV shot, I was going, well, where are its eyes? Well, how is this point of view? We can see its teeth from the inside.
Yeah, but because it is inside, because it comes out from its mouth.
But that's a secondary mouth, right?
Oh, the BBC always struggled with alien points of view, though, didn't they? Back in the 70s and 80s, all those Doctor Who, they'll just put some blue gauze over it and spin it round.
Yes, the idea that is what it's like to be.
Yeah.
What it's like to be a fly is really confusing.
Exactly, yes. Yeah.
As though its brain doesn't make those things into one composite image.
Yeah. That's why it can't get out of rooms. It just spends its entire life going, yeah. What is going on?
There's eight of everything. Help.
Maybe that's another reference to Alien, though, right? The Giga alien doesn't have any eyes.
Yeah, yeah.
And it does have that weird second mouth thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, it doesn't have visible... Does it ever have visible eyes?
They give him some weird eye sockets in Alien Resurrection.
When it scuttles away, that's a very clear scene.
Yeah.
Homage, isn't it? When it's his monstrosity of a chili food thing.
Yeah.
The sausage. That runs away. That's just... got out of John Hurt.
Yeah.
Yes.
At that point.
I think they really have their cake and eat it with this whole thing. If there are no aliens in Red Dwarf, they always have an explanation for why they've come from the human world, you know, the remnant of human civilization. But I mean, this is, you get the cutesy gremlin-y type alien, and then you get the proper, what is that if not an alien?
It was like,
and also, you do know, when is this set?
Right.
In what way? Like, I know obviously it's 3 million years from the late 22nd century, but also, why are all the things the polymorph changes into? It's like, because there's a second polymorph episode as well, and it does a slinky. I mean, it's obviously been brought up in some sort of retro shop. Yeah. Or
a fringe lampshade, yes.
or a landline with a curly cord.
All the 80s references as well. That was like, why would they choose the 80s references?
Yeah, right.
You know?
But I thought it was really funny, just like, how are we going to know? It could be anything. It could be this Garfield.
I love that chili powder gag, the not too much, not too little. That's just so nicely set up, isn't it?
Again, with the sort of sci-fi, I can't help but think of it quite literally of like, what is he doing? That must be all the chili powder in the universe.
Can you imagine the stocks on Red Dwarf if that's how he's making dinner? But he says there is a special dinner. It looks very romantic to me.
Yeah. Going back to something you said earlier, Kirsty, about the sort of these four misfits living together. Those moments like this dinner party being prepared, and we've had other episodes where Rimmer's cooked and everybody's feeling really ill, but he's really enjoyed making a meal for everyone somehow with his can't touch anything hands. But it's, you get these little glimpses into, oh, they're not just having scrapes every week. There are long periods of time that go by where they are just
cohabiting
along. Yeah. Cohabiting. And presumably getting on okay. Those hints at that really kind of help you to bed in with the characters for me.
Thinking about it, because that was my preparation for going and living with strangers at university, I suppose.
Yeah.
And I did meet very similar characters like that in my whole services. There was the officious one that ended up being that nobody liked her. If I was going to recast, I realised I'd be doing it with real people that you don't know. I know who I'd recast. Yeah, and they were all people I lived with in my first year of university. Wow.
A couple of times Lister in that scene goes, it's been cleaned.
Yes.
So not understanding what's objectionable about, using an artificial insemination syringe to... Yeah, that's so me.
That is so Nick.
As long as you run it underwater, it's fine.
If you do these tests, there are these tests to find out about your disgust levels. And they're full of things like, would you eat off a toilet seat that was straight out of the factory and was completely clean? So there's no hygienic reason you should, but like some people absolutely would not.
The principle. It's where someone's going to put their bottom.
Yeah. You don't know, time's definitely only one direction.
Well, I was going to say, yes. How do you know that someone hasn't, when you weren't looking at it? There's a high probability that someone might when you were not looking.
That's what they're for.
That's also possible of any plate.
What are you doing? What are you doing with our plates? Oh, God.
Can we talk about what is probably the biggest audience reaction in the show to date? The shrunken underpants and Crichton.
Rimmer walking in.
Yeah. I mean, they are absolutely on the floor, that audience.
Yes.
It's almost problematic, isn't it? You're so aware it's not canned laughter.
Yeah.
No, that they would have faded it by now.
Yeah. There's a making of documentary where where Chris Parry talks about coming in and just having to guess when he could say his line. And they were just kind of shouting at each other because they couldn't hear a thing over that.
The line is even better for how long it takes.
Yeah.
I can't say I'm completely surprised.
When I was watching, I was going, what are they laughing at? Are they laughing at the fact that there's a groinal socket, or are they just laughing at the fact that it looks like... But like, where is the line there in terms of what people are finding so funny about it?
Just the punchline being gay. kind of was a thing in the 80s, wasn't it? So when was this? Was it 89. Like 1989? So yeah. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I guess it still was. There was probably an element of that, but I think it's more to do with the fact that it's two characters you know and love by now, and they're having a tussle.
In a completely ridiculous and humiliating
situation.
It's the humiliation.
You mentioned the Chekhov's gun thing, John, in the recap, but this is Chekhov's groinal socket, right?
Yes, it is.
Let's chat the monster then. It's pretty impressive, I think, the look of that thing when we get not the little cutesy gremlin, but the full-sized alien with its sucky-out fear attachment tongue or whatever.
I think for low-budget BBC 1989, that's a proper monster.
Yeah, it looks. Fleshy, doesn't it? It's sort of when it's in whatever xenomorph. Even the fact it's called polymorph this episode is an alien reference, right? Sort of, because they're called xenomorphs.
We've been picking up on alien references all the way through the series. In previous episodes, they've got lines like "In space, no one can hear you, cha cha cha," and a couple of little bits. At one point, when Starbuck's flying through space in a later series, you can actually see the escape pod that Ripley takes at the end of Alien as one of the ships that's floating around. The show is full of references to this film,
right?
Film series, but particularly this first one. But they don't do what Ridley Scott does. They show you a lot of this monster all the way through, right? There's frame-filling moments of it.
I think because they'd spent so long making it look so impressive, they were like, let's get our money
to show it off.
Yeah.
I really, really enjoy it. It's one of my favourite sight gags from Naked Gun is when someone throws a pillow at Frank Drebin and he goes, "Ah!"
Yes.
Like it's stuck to his face attacking him constantly with teeth and claws. I really enjoy it. And there's a couple of those in this that really, I really, really like Craig Charles getting to do with the snake and before that with the chili.
It reminds me of Ash in Evil Dead 2 with the hand attacking himself.
Yes.
I love that. And Craig Charles is really good at it as well. I love that kebab strangling him bit.
Yeah.
And the writing of the way they set up for the big reveal with the snake coming out. Oh, that's my second worst fear. That's just such a such a great setup for what's your worst fear of all time. And there it is.
Although we have talked in the past about the great editing in the show.
Mm.
And that is a bit of really weird editing. Like the editor, you can just imagine the poor editor in the suite going, "I'm sorry, Mr. Producer, please don't fire me. We don't have the footage to get the snake onto Crichton." And the producer's gone, "It's fine. Cut from that shot to that shot. It'll be fine."
Yeah.
Well, because it would have been somebody who's just been in the Blue Peter studio and now he's bringing the snake through.
Yeah. Yes.
He's doing the round. Okay, it's sleepy after meeting all those kids. Now let's put it.
And Francis Barber turns up.
Yes, Olivier nominated already at this point.
Not for this.
No, not for this.
She'd already been in a Stephen Frears film by this time. She's working with Dennis Potter, and she just rocks up as Jenny, according to the credits.
Her trajectory literally went Lady Macbeth at the Royal Exchange in Manchester, Viola in a TV movie of Twelfth Night, Jenny in Polymorph. And I can only assume that what happened is that her agent phoned her up and said, "The BBC wants you to play the title role in Polymorph."
And she thought it was the story about a small plasticine man with an open marriage.
Yes, exactly. Yes. Yeah.
Did you notice Kat's accent?
He slips just a tiny bit right at the moment when
Jenny's seducing him full on.
Yeah. I did notice that.
That's quite funny.
It's the classic actor's tell, isn't it? When someone
is
really emotional and they just slip into their own voice because they can't help it. Yeah, he's tapping into something primal.
I think she's tapping into it. But...
She managed to let him kind of whoop.
Yeah.
I don't know if you've ever met Francis Barber up close, but you do lose your accent.
Really, is that what happens?
I love that bit of when you realise, oh God, they're all really stupid, all these characters. Like, the cat is sort of, well, it's not kind of like tree-level stupid. It's just talking to a woman that he's never seen before.
And explaining to her that, you know, she's got to watch out for her.
Yeah.
That's brilliant.
Yeah. It's another great example of Danny John-Jules just selling something that on paper just seems utterly implausible that you could make us buy that. But we kind of do. Or I did anyway.
Yeah.
Spring is my favorite time to start a new workout routine. With the weather warming up, it feels easier to get into the rhythm of things. Whether you have 20 minutes or an hour for a Pilates class or outdoor guided walk, Peloton has everything you need to help you get going. Get a head start on summer with Peloton at onepeloton.com.
I love getting to see alt versions of the characters in this show. Seeing them all without a key component of their character removed and what that does to them. I can never get enough of Crichton not being servile. I just love it.
I don't care. Yeah. in fact, becoming the one who throws around the insults the most.
Yeah, yeah, he's the one with the most ruthless survival plan out of all of them. Yeah. After putting everyone first for his entire existence, and now he's like, no.
Sacrifice Lister, and yep. Lister's like, yes!
Yeah, which is no great. It makes no sense at all.
I love as well that the Ribber now smokes a pipe.
Yes.
Yes.
Hologrammatically.
And a lot of hand movement.
Oh, a lot of very gentle sharing hand movement. Yeah.
Yes, yes.
He apparently improvised that. So what we see is scripted, but apparently they originally wrote a different type of character that he would become without his anger. And they just played around with it in rehearsal, and Chris Barry just improvised this sort of 60s peacenik character.
Right.
And they loved it so much that they took notes of all the things he was saying and basically kind of cherry-picked the best lines and shaped them into his dialogue. And then that's what made it into the final episode, which is great. Legend. I love the fact that they were able to play and explore that much in rehearsals.
And let him give you what he knew was going to be funniest as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What I love about Crichton's loss of guilt is the telegraphing of what's going to happen to him when he gets it back. He's so upset when he calls Rimmer's mum a trout. Yes. Like, trout. So upset.
They all do very much, set up what they're going to lose for maximum effect, don't they?
Definitely. Yeah, Craig has so much fun with that aggression, I think. He's just really loving that, getting to just turn on the taps with the iconic scene with the baseball bat.
A lot of iconic stuff. Let's get out there and twat it.
Let's get out there and twat it.
And what a lovely, that's a great bit of Craig Charles timing that as well, isn't it? Nicely telegraphed, and then he sits up into the shot.
I think my favourite shot in the entire episode is Chris Barry's face when he's been head sucked.
And it lasts for a while, doesn't it?
Mm. It's just gloriously ridiculous and without any huge effects done. It's like he's just making this insane face.
Yeah.
That's very, very funny indeed. But then when the polymorph is him, it's also pretty disturbing. But they stretch the forehead out of the
way. That's really weird, that moment of effect, isn't it? We're just going to distort his head to look like a Mekon.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then, yeah, that was weird.
Yeah,
but,
it's very
but really, I remember it being very scary when I was... Oh, no, I shouldn't have found it that scary. I was quite old. Never mind.
When I was 28, watching it for the first time.
Yeah.
Then, yeah, I guess we go on to the Rimmer's mum bit.
Yeah.
Although we didn't really talk about the video, did we, before that?
No, we didn't, but let's talk about that now, yeah. What did you make of that?
I mean, it's just so tragic.
It's so sad. His life is
it's
so
awful.
Sad.
It's so,
but he's quite, you know, this is one of the better moments of it.
What the level of delusion he's managed to achieve in thinking that those were his brother's roughhousing with him, as opposed to abusing
what?
Him.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, just some normal, nothing weird. And yeah, you see them feeding him out.
Properly beating him up.
Rough.
Have we seen this before? Do we know up until this point that he has videos of himself as a child?
No, we haven't.
No, this is the first time, I think.
We know he's got brothers, because he cites the fact that they all got into the Space Corps and he didn't.
We know that his mum calls him Rimmer.
Yes.
Yes.
We know that his family is fractious and awful, but this is the first time we've actually seen his mum and brothers.
Yeah, it's the actual evidence.
It's pretty rough.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then just when you feel a bit sorry for him, then you... Oh.
But do you think this whole thing is about... This episode feels like... Yes, it's awesome to see what the characters are like with those key emotions removed, but also the writers must have had so much fun getting the characters to the point of extreme emotion like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
Working out how to make Rimmer more angry, to make him angrier than he's been ever before.
Yes.
That's a nice thing to work out how to write, right?
Yes.
And it's just so... Why doesn't Lister say no? Why does Lister at no point go, no, I haven't shagged your
mum? Because he's got no fear.
I know, yeah.
I guess they've just knocked Lister out with a powerful sedative.
Yeah. That's true.
Is that the excuse?
Yeah.
That probably has to be an excuse. Well, and go, also yeah. no well, fear, it's... yeah. And also he hasn't had sex in a long time. And she wasn't going to take no for an answer either, I think.
That's true.
Could the polymorph just appear to River as Lister, say? I don't know. Should the father of polymorph actually bothers to have sex with Lister so as to get River to this...
maximum anger. Yeah. Yeah.
And what does it? It's not, you know...
It's alphabetic spaghetti.
It's alphabetic spaghetti, yeah. it's up there with gazpacho soup yeah. as his yeah. triggers.
Yeah. How about you, Kirsty? What's your favourite bit in the app?
I do just love how silly and cute the polymorph is. Like, from the first bit, I'm like, this is hilarious. And then just how ridiculous it is. And then its little gremlin noises. And especially when it's a little sausage and just kind of scuttles away after strangling.
Yeah.
I don't know. There's so many good bits.
I have a question about the... voiceover at the beginning, so there's the warning, and we could go, all right, that's the makers of this television show warning me about the content that's about to come, and then sure, you know what I'm about to say, right?
Yeah.
Then there is an explanation of what the polymorph is,
yes,
and how you should be very careful of it.
Yeah, right.
And then who is saying that, and who are they saying it to?
I think maybe it's sort of being beamed out into the ether from the pod, but I don't know if that actually makes sense. Like they've locked this thing in the pod, jettisoned it off in the hope it never encounters anyone. But just in case it does,
loudspeaker sort of thing.
Yeah, it's like keep away from this thing.
Keep away from this.
Yeah,
you don't want to let this free.
Famously, sound travels well in space, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Famously,
everyone could hear you scream.
It might explain why Holly then knows what it is. That would be quite in keeping with how Holly behaves a lot of the time, wouldn't it? Because Holly comes straight in with, "Oh, it's man-made, it's a genetic experiment that went wrong." It's a shape-changing warrior. It's gone insane. It's an emotional vampire. Yeah. And you sort of think, well, how do you know all that just from watching it be some underpants? And it's because it's because Holly's heard the warning and just gone, oh, this will be interesting.
I think that's tied it up perfectly, so well done.
Well, I did like, also, it says on it, content to.
Content to.
But it doesn't say two really bad things.
Yes.
Yeah.
Contains, two cornflakes may have settled in transit. What?
It's been 35 years and it's only just occurring to me that doesn't make any sense. Oh, no.
Content to.
Content to.
That's index.
It's just in case they want to recycle later, they can be to something else. Is this the only one that has a warning at the beginning?
Yeah, it is the only one with a pre-credits warning, I think.
There was a lot of marketing around this episode. The BBC really sold it as all the trailers for it were done in the Alien style. So they were really selling it as a horror. The iPlayer Precy that we have in previous episodes mocked is taken directly from the Radio Times at the time, which says something like the crew of Red Dwarf are subjected to 24 hours of gruesome horror.
Oh, wow.
Oh,
gruesome
wow.
Horror. Yeah, so they were trying to amp up
they
people's
were coming up.
About it.
We had that conversation, didn't we? We watched it about, does it reset?
The twist at the end. Oh, there's contents too, and then...
It's Lister, yeah.
But then it's Lister, but then it's not. What is it? What, you know, and it's like, you know...
Yeah, how many episodes is Lister a polymorph?
Yeah.
Is he still one?
From then on.
When it aired, I think they left it ambiguous, but I read something like in the remastered version, they said the polymorph had disappeared into Lister's clean underpants straw, and like that's how they got rid of it, because it was just never picked up again.
It died of old age.
Ah, nice. Just about every episode ends with a thing that you go, oh, is this going to... We've talked about this in series one, when Lister passes the officer exam, and then next episode turns out he didn't.
I know. And then it's like, nah, it's a sitcom.
Yeah,
it's the funnies, isn't it? It's
Let
for the
it
funnies.
Go.
Yeah.
Yeah,
it's for jokes. Maybe that's the problem with combining sci-fi and comedy, right? That sci-fi
you want
fans
continuity.
Do enjoy a bit of continuity.
Yeah. Yeah,
exactly. And it's telling that Grant and Naylor did come back to some stuff and turn it into running threads.
Mm.
Yes, there was a lot more of that in the later series, wasn't there, I think? But
yeah, recurring kind of side characters and stuff like that. If you watch the next episode and you're like, oh, why isn't there a polymorph in it? Like, I don't know, you're kind of missing out, aren't you, a bit? Like, that was last episode, it's fine. Make it up, he's in the underwear drawer, that's it.
Yeah.
We're much more used now to sitcoms having a through arc.
An arc, yeah.
Because we consume them in a way where we don't wait a week to find out what happens. They don't just reset, like, you know, the Seinfeld thing, no hugging, no learning. It's like sitcoms used to just be absolutely a universe, you know. Nothing from last week is going to make much difference to next week. And nowadays, the thing you're watching the sitcom on wants you to keep watching.
Yeah.
Everyone had forgotten what happened the week before by the time it came around again.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Yeah, it made sense to start from scratch just because actually trying to remember what happened without having to do a big recap.
That explains that then. Thanks, guys.
Yes, well, you never used to think, I wonder if Scooby will ever make up with Velma.
Yeah.
After that argument they had, you know, you never for a moment wondered, oh, this is going to sour things next week.
Have you had the Red Dwarf theme requested at a sing-along? That's great.
Yeah, I was really surprised because I've been doing a sing-along for years. Like, I started it about 15 years ago. And then the last one I did in Hebden Bridge, I guess like an informal one where I'm just sitting at an actual piano, an upright piano, and people just come and stick their post-it note requests on the piano. And I looked down and I had two separate ones saying Red Dwarf theme tune.
Amazing.
I was like,
amazing.
Wow, no one's ever asked for that before. I've got to do it. And like the whole room just absolutely going for it. It was brilliant hearing a whole room of people, like 100 people all singing at the tops of their voices. Yeah.
Isn't that, mate? I hope Howard Goodall knows what he's done.
Yeah. I think he must do by now, right?
Something being that indelible. No one remembers the lyrics to the Dear John theme tune.
No.
You know what I mean? Like,
no.
But... I do.
Oh.
apart from me, these are the only music questions he gets right.
80s theme tune. 80s theme tune.
Yeah.
Delivers by Kraftwerk.
It's such a clever song. And she's belting it all the way through as well. It's a good song to sing loud.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's why it worked so well as a sing-along, because everyone was just like, yeah! Go for it! It raised the roof. It was quite tricky to pick a good one to follow. It was very interesting that everyone knew it. Given how kind of alone I felt at school watching Red Dwarf, this is what I mean. Mm. Or maybe it's just that I attract the people to my gig that did watch Red Dwarf. Or maybe everyone's just watched Red Dwarf by now. Maybe that's what it is. I don't know. I think it's a bit the same that I was shamed for being a massive Queen fan when I was a teenager, because I was, you know, no one else was into Queen at all. So I had to just kind of just be into it by myself.
Yeah, I very much relate to that. Queen is a band and Red Dwarf is a sitcom. They both just give you worlds to escape into.
Queen as Red Dwarf. Oh my god, there's my recasting.
Okay, who's who?
Who's my recasting?
Oh my god, yes. Oh yes, please do that. Okay. Yeah.
Roger is Lister, and I mean, very...
Oh, this is tough.
This is hard, isn't it? Yeah.
Tough to cast a Rimmer.
Brian won't like him, but he's Rimmer.
They've had a fractious relationship when they were younger, those guys. I think that works.
Freddie is Cat.
Yes.
John is Holly. Maybe.
There it is.
I like it.
We've mapped it.
Okay, there's my recasting for you. There you go.
I love that.
Ah, sweet.
I'm sorry for taking it down such a Queen rabbit hole, everyone. Sorry.
Look at John's face. Oh, he's great. Absolutely delighted.
Yeah, I'm thrilled.
It was just that. It was the same era for me. It was my teens. So yeah, my uncool teens.
So it was a lot of people being sad and lonely, not realising that other people were sad and lonely as well.
It was pre-internet.
It was pre-internet, yeah, exactly. It wasn't...
Mm,
yeah, everything's much better now we have the internet.
Much better. Really brings it together.
Talking of internet, where can people find you online?
Yeah, they can find me at kirstynewton.com, which will be updated shortly. You can find me, I guess, with the Comedy Store Players quite a few Sundays. So have a look at the listings and come along and watch me make up stuff with another load of legends I was watching in my teens that have now become friends and colleagues, which is wonderful.
We're sort of nickduty.com. Look at that. I'm all over the place in terms of stand-up, so I'll be coming somewhere near you soon. At Nick Doody on Twitter, you know, every 3 to 6 months I'll tweet something. These days, and I'm so bad at Instagram that everyone who's looked me up thinks it's a dormant account.
Oh, no.
If you're really into chess, you'll be able to catch me chess streaming as well.
Oh, wow.
Oh, my gosh.
I just started those again.
Well, thank you for coming on. It's been great.
Yeah,
thank you so much.
It's been lovely.
That was history in the making.
It was.
Our first ever two-guest special.
Well, we had to do something special for episode 15, right?
Exactly, yeah.
What a legendary pair. That was so cool.
Yeah, it was brilliant.
Again, with the insights. 15 episodes in and we're still hearing clever things about why Red Dwarf didn't necessarily need continuity as much as modern sitcoms. And, oh, yeah, lovely business. And for the first time, frankly, hearing that Red Dwarf had social value.
Yeah.
I know there were conferences and there were clubs, the fan club, obviously, and you could find people who were into the show, especially as it got more and more popular. But I still found it very edifying to hear that there were 18-year-olds sat in pubs in the late 80s and early
90s. Communally watching it.
Yeah, watching it.
Like a football game.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it's amazing.
I've still got my fascination with structure, by the way. It's a 29-minute programme. It's 2 minutes before we see a human being.
Yeah.
It's 16 minutes, I think, before anyone has an emotion sucked out of them.
Yeah.
I remember it being a thorough exploration of what it would be like with these characters, with these prime emotions being ripped away from them. But no, it's only 5 minutes of the show.
That's a pattern, isn't it? Things build incredibly slowly and then escalate extraordinarily quickly. Over and over again.
Even having just watched it, my memory is of it being perfectly paced and not missing anything out.
They're very good, aren't they?
They are good, aren't they?
And that the amount of stuff the polymorph becomes before it hops off as a bunny rabbit, that's audacious. So many different things they show us. I love that.
It's another good way of getting in like your guest stars as well by having them play things that the polymorph takes on.
Yeah, that's very true.
Yeah.
That is very true. Frances Barber somehow plays it like she knows how thick Kat is being in that moment. Do you know what I mean? Somehow there's a second layer. There's a subtext she's playing of this idiot.
Yes, the polymorph itself doesn't feel the need to not comment on its on the fiction.
There's no justifying its presence at all.
Yeah.
The actual look of the polymorph itself feels kind of like, it feels like gremlins and Ghostbusters, but was that, might be a dumb question, but what was this sort of invented in the 80s?
I think so.
Is it an 80s monster, I think is the question.
Yes. 1982, John Carpenter's The Thing happened. And that, I think, was the thing that made everyone go, oh my gosh, you can do what with prosthetics? Just crazy, crazy, crazy stuff in that. A lot of body horror unpleasantness, but mixed in with kind of alien features and some really unpleasant stuff happening to dogs in it as well.
But it invaded the whole culture, didn't it? Because kids' toys by the late 80s, like there was a whole gross thing, like disgusting rubbery puppets and monsters and all sorts of... It really became a thing of the 80s.
There wasn't just Gremlins either. There was a series of films called Ghoulies, Critters. But also, I think the fleshiness and the sliminess of it. Even you look at Spaceballs, Pizza the Hut, in that has a lot of shared DNA with the polymorph, I think.
But I think, like Kirsty was saying, the smaller polymorph is kind of cute, I think.
Yes. Through 80s eyes, it definitely is, yeah. And it's scared of its own reflection as well, which is kind of inherently cute.
Did you get scared? I got disappointed.
Oh, did you?
I thought it was like, ugh, I'm not going to be able to seduce any people if I look like this, was what I got from that little,
Right, the psychological explanation, I like it.
I think that the scariest alien is one that isn't bipedal and vaguely humanoid. And I still couldn't tell you exactly what shape the polymorph is, right? You never see its legs. Can we talk about Crichton's line, disgusting pus-filled bubo? Because the second half of that joke is, I think, funnier, right? But the disgusting pus-filled bubo is a really nice insult line. And again, only the third episode we've seen him speaking. It's quite a lean on that word. He's clearly enjoying the insult that the writers have given him. Maybe a bit too much. Because also, what laugh there is covers up the next bit of the joke.
Yeah, bubo is colourful enough as a word that you don't need to probably emphasise it that much, right? But that said, I take quite a lot of pleasure in the way that he says it.
It's a nice little kind of tokenistic effort towards being an android, right? Because it's not necessarily an accent that anyone in real life speaks with. It's kind of Californian Valley speak. Oh, hey, hello.
It's meant to be British Columbian, apparently, yeah.
Yeah, I have a lot of family in British Columbia. I don't know.
Oh, yeah, I don't think it's a good Canadian accent.
Oh, I see. Well, then it's a lot of bad accents.
It's the Canadian accent of someone who's heard a Canadian accent once and the internet doesn't exist yet, so they can't check whether what they remember is actually accurate.
Right.
We'll come back to polymorphs in the show. But for now, let's load Polymorph back into the genetic waste pod and look ahead to next week's monster of the week. It's Tom Price.
Oh my days.
And he's here to talk about Body Swap.
How exciting is that? I can't wait. Listener, we'll see you there.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.